This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Depending on when you grew up, discipline in school can mean anything from a timeout to detention to that proverbial ruler against the knuckles. But a former teacher says that in some school systems, there is next to no discipline at all, and that is doing kids a disservice.
In the schools that I visited, there were no consequences for behavior that was what we call errant behavior, out of control behavior, which was very different from the way I grew up.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation about school discipline and the appropriately named book, Sit Down and Shut Up. We'll also spend an academic minute with teenagers and energy drinks, because what could possibly go wrong there? I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Being a substitute teacher is not easy, especially in one of the largest school systems in the country. Cinque Henderson took on that job in Los Angeles County, where he worked in public, private, and charter schools. He found that chaos and lack of discipline at home spilled over into the classroom almost every day. He wrote about his experiences in his new book called Sit Down and Shut Up: How Discipline Can Set Students Free. Cinque Henderson is now a former teacher and current writer for film and television. He wrote for Aaron Sorkin's HBO series The Newsroom and is currently a writer for the Showtime series The Chi. His writing has also appeared in The New Yorker, Newsweek, The Washington Post, and elsewhere. I asked him why he took on a book project and why this topic. And one quick note, when we spoke to Cinque, he was on his cell phone, so some of the audio can be a bit wonky, but the content is awesome.
Well, you know, I'm a writer, and I'm a bit of a bum as a writer in the sense that if it's up to me, I go to bed at 4 in the morning. And so as I was on writing something that wasn't connected to this, and a friend of mine who was a principal suggested to me that I should substitute teach once or twice a week. And I thought, you know, this is a good idea to help me organize my day, make me get up early, make me feel less like a vagabond. So I did it. Both of my parents are educators. I've always valued education. I tutored in high school. I tutored in college. I tutored after college when I worked at DreamWorks. I tutored when I worked for Sorkin. I tutored. So I've always liked that. And so I took a few days gig subbing and had a unusual experience. And in short order, probably by the end of the week, as difficult as those first day experiences were, they were also kind of thrilling to me in a certain way, because as I said, I've always loved education. I really highly value teachers. My teachers are personal heroes to me. And in short order, realized that there was a lot to be uncovered in this experience about the United States, about America, about race, about how kids interact with adults, how kids interact with each other, and just about what it means to live in a complex democracy. And just kind of stuck with it, loved it, and felt, quite frankly, that it was something of a calling being a teacher, which I hadn't expected to feel.
Where were you subbing?
I was subbing in charter schools and public schools, and actually ultimately in some private schools as well, all over Los Angeles. One day I'd be in a really tough charter school or real tough public school in East L.A., and the next day I might be in a private Jewish Orthodox school in West L.A., or in Beverly Hills. So it was quite an experience.
Did you find the problems with discipline were equal in all schools?
No, and it was actually quite startling because, as I said, I'd be in a really tough school in a tough or poor neighborhood one day, and the sort of chaos of the students, the adolescent chaos, as I call it, would be very difficult to deal with. And then I'd be in a middle class or upper middle class or wealthy school, and it would be an entirely different thing. But the thing that was also interesting to me was that, at least in the schools that I visited, there were no consequences for behavior that was what we call errant behavior, out of control behavior, which was very different from the way I grew up. And I didn't understand why this was going on. I only found out later in the year about why this had come about, why this had happened. And I want to say before we go on, even though I taught in Black and Latin inner city schools, this is not really a story about race, although those were the students I was interacting with. I'm obviously African-American, but this isn't as much a story about race as it is as much about what happens to communities when there is economic deprivation, when jobs are driven out. And then there was another aspect of things. In fact, the most So really the harshest thing that I heard about student behavior or came across during the year I was writing this, actually, was a quote from the book Hillbilly Elegy, which was a big hit about a year ago about white kids, poor white kids in sort of the Appalachian corridor. And it was a white teacher talking about this white students that she was teaching. And it's a harsh quote, but I think it kind of points to one of the themes of the book. And there's something along the lines of they want us to be shepherds to these kids, but no one talks about the fact that many of them are raised by wolves. Horribly harsh quote. Please don't attribute that to the way I think. But my point is that was a white teacher talking about poor white students. And it gets to really one of the themes of the book, adolescent chaos really is a symptom of societies that have, or communities that have disintegrated for many reasons, the primary one being economic, but there are many things that branch out from that, which I only discovered, again, this year was kind of solving a mystery, really. How had in the generation when I was young, I grew up in a relatively working class to poor neighborhood in the South. We had our discipline problems, kids fought each other, that sort of thing, but no one cursed at teachers, no one fought teachers, no one aggressed against teachers. And that was something that was sort of startling to me. Within about a few weeks of working at one school in particular, a teacher who had gone to this school as a high school student himself, he was now teaching there, and he said, you know, the school was always tough. With students, we used to fight each other. Now students fight the teacher. And I have to tell you, it stunned me. And I realized that he was right, and it was really the beginning of a mystery for me, and I was trying to figure out what had happened. Why had, in the course of a generation, a population of students in this tough, you know, poor area gone from fighting each other, which kids always do, to being aggressive towards teachers?
One of the notes I took going through the book was the classroom was a mirror of the neighborhood.
Yeah, exactly. And that comment by that teacher really stuck with me. It really haunted me, actually. And I could not sort out what had happened, but it was clear to me that, as I say in the book, a Rubicon had been crossed, that something had happened, something had unsettled these neighborhoods. And it wasn't until I was driving home one day after a pretty tough day, and of all people, Sean Carter, also known as Jay-Z, Beyonce's husband, came on the radio. They were interviewing him on NPR, Terry Gross. And she asked him, she said, what was the effect of crack cocaine coming into your neighborhood? And he said the most startling thing. It destroyed the authority figure. And it was such a shocking thing, I almost got into a wreck. I almost crashed into the car in front of me. And I didn't know what he was talking about at the time. I subsequently dived into the research. But what he said crack cocaine was so addictive, and so many adults got hooked to it. And the dealers were kids. And so I started to go into the research about crack cocaine. And there are economists who have said that the effect of crack cocaine on poor inner city neighborhoods cannot be underestimated. There's one quote that said it swept through those poor communities like the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. There is another very serious economist who said that black America was catching up to white America on all the major indices of health, be it child mortality, graduation rates, income, until the crack cocaine epidemic hit. And the only thing that was more devastating in the last 60 years was Jim Crow regulations in the South. And as I looked into what Jay-Z said, I realized because of the very harsh punishments that were meted out to adults for dealing crack, drug dealers, they were set during the Reagan administration. If you were an adult and you dealt crack, you could go to jail for 10 years. It was just exorbitantly high cost for dealing crack cocaine. So what they did is they employed young people. They employed kids. Crack cocaine was essentially a child's economy, and they were paying their parents' light bills. So really, in these inner city communities, jobs had been driven out because of the loss of manufacturing work. Crack cocaine was really the only job in town, and it was run day-to-day by 14, 15-year-olds who were dealing to their aunts, their preachers, their pastors. And because crack cocaine was so powerfully addictive, people could not help but debase themselves. It was such an aggressive drug, and the young people saw this. And so what I realized is that those kids eventually grew up, and then they had kids, and they've come into these schools. They lost quite naturally, quite reasonably, frankly, all respect for adults because the adults were debasing themselves before the 13 and 14-year-olds who were making the money, and they grew up without respect for traditional authority. They had kids, and those are the kids that I was dealing with. I was dealing with the kids of those kids. And I raise that issue because if you look at the opioid crisis now in the Midwest, the white, poor white communities, they are experiencing and will be aggressively experiencing the same thing that these inner city neighborhoods dealt with crack cocaine. This is sort of one of the opening chapters of the book, and that teacher who said, kids used to fight each other, now they fight the adults. That was one of the beginnings of it. They had lost all reasonable regard and respect for the domestic social authority of the adults in their immediate neighborhood. And teachers were one of the last vestiges of that authority.
I'm going to ask you a question that you started one of your chapters with. Why should any of us care whether kids are behaving in school? And I'll put an addition to that, unless, of course, there are kids.
Right, exactly. This is a complex question in the sense that I had to really think at some point. You know, the subtitle of the book is called How Discipline Can Set Students Free. And I had to ask myself, why do you care about this? I have a good life and a good career. I write for television. I don't make my living as a teacher, although I struggled with whether I would become a full-time teacher, and I sort of leave the book with the question whether that was something I was going to do, and I'll let the reader figure that out. That's another story.
No spoiler alert here?
Yeah, no spoiler alert.
Okay.
And so I had to ask, why is it crucially important in a democracy or in our country that kids know how to control their impulses, present themselves to the society in a way that is respectable and that sort of thing? And so I really started to look into it, and it was really came down to the question of what it means to be a citizen, what it means to live in a democracy. And many people say, oh, you know, the importance of education is so kids can grow up to get jobs. But that isn't really, I think, as fundamental a question, particularly when we talk about what it means to be an American, what it means to live in this society. And one of the things that I realized is that for poor kids, for poor black kids, for poor Latin kids, if we look at the crisis today, is unless poor kids, poor black kids can control their anger, can control their rage, and they have their right to it. They've grown up in these impoverished neighborhoods that have been destroyed by violence and crack cocaine and police brutality. They have a right to that anger, but they also are obligated, if they're going to be thriving citizens, to control it, to channel it properly. And at the point at which they do sort of raise their hand and say, look, there's something wrong here. Something is happening to us. Something is happening to our community. Something is happening to our world. We need your help. We need your support. We need you as an ally in a way that is respectable and decent and controlled will win them allies. And I think that is a question that goes to the heart of what it means to be a democratic citizen. I think it goes to the heart of what it means to live in a complex society where there are always competing goals and competing needs. So I guess that's the fundamental reason why kids need to learn to sit down and shut up.
Still to come, our conversation with Cinque Henderson continues with a look at why middle school should be the most important school. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Cinque Henderson, a former substitute teacher and the author of the new book, Sit Down and Shut Up, How Discipline Can Set Students Free. In the book, he offers some suggestions for what he sees as the current lack of discipline in schools, and he starts with the suggestion that middle school should be seen as the most important school years. I asked him why.
Well, particularly with boys, but with girls too, and I saw this And I taught for a while in middle school, and I saw the difference between, and anybody who has had middle-aged children will know, I saw what happened when I taught a sixth grader who had just come from fifth grade, and then I saw them a while later as a seventh grader. And the difference between a child pre-hormones and post-hormones is night and day, and any parent knows this. And a child changes in such a fundamental way when the hormones kick in. And all of the chaos and all of psychological and emotional issues that any child that is sort of encoded or nascent in a child's nature comes out in spades in middle school. The different directions, whether a boy is going to go in one direction or another, can be tracked to really middle school when their sexual nature kicks in, when they start to see themselves and compare themselves to other boys, compare themselves to girls, and that sort of thing. And because middle schools have such a heightened time for kids, boys and girls, that it really is a time to for us to clamp down in a wise, hopefully, and informed way and really start to shape and intervene in the lives of students, especially preferably with, I think we need more male teachers, black or white, certainly in black neighborhoods and Latin neighborhoods, more black and Latin male teachers. All the behavior problems really begin in earnest then. I mean, you can see them earlier, but they become exaggerated again when kids start to develop a sexual nature. Cursing in earnest starts in middle school. It really is just because it's thought of in between time, it gets actually less attention. But it's precisely because it's an in between stage that it should be getting more attention financially and just culturally in our society. We really, really need to start to really pay attention and to provide poor kids and black kids and just all kids in public schools more support in those middle years.
Another one of your suggestions, which I'm sure people would find controversial, is you want to bring back reform schools.
Well, I say bring back reform schools and reform them. That's what I say. So I just want to be clear about what I mean. And, you know, call them something else. Call them alternative schools. You know, they have a horrible and quite rightly history and reputation. They were many jails, as far as I can tell. I was fortunate I never experienced one directly. But really, and this kind of gets to my issue about charter schools, about which I am not a huge fan, but charter schools were initially thought of. One of the inventors of the idea of charter schools envisioned them as alternative schools for kids who are the least socialized. So their thought was take the kids who have trouble learning in traditional schools because of intellectual reasons or because of behavior or emotional reasons and give them small schools, small classes, direct intervention with, you know, one-on-one intervention with teachers and counselors and that sort of thing. And so in a way, charter schools, the very original idea of charter schools, were as an alternative school for kids who are having trouble learning. Charter schools, unfortunately, have become alternative schools for kids who have a great time learning, who are the best kids, and in a way, the kids who need the least direct intervention. And so they actually kind of went in the exact opposite direction of something that would have been helpful. And so when I say bring back reform schools, I really just mean less find schools where we can really administer in a detailed and targeted way to the needs of the kids who have the worst reactions coming out of these broken homes, coming out of these impoverished neighborhoods, who have been the least socialized, have the most difficult time dealing with their impulses and their anger, and give them the kind of both loving and stringent attention that is needed for them to subdue their impulses and move out into society as adults and be thriving and important. So it's not, you know, the reform schools of old that I mean. I just mean we can't throw kids away. I believe in bringing back suspensions. You also need expulsions to some degree. But let's not throw them away. Let's find places for them. And they are models in the country. There's some really good ones out of Pennsylvania, some that really find a way to administer to the needs of the kids who are struggling the most, group therapy, individual therapy, all that sort of thing. I really feel that's one of our obligations as citizens, as society, to the young, and help them learn to discipline themselves and control their own worst instincts.
And finally, you do have a job suggestion for former President Obama.
I did indeed. Before he left office, which caused a great deal of strain for many of us, stress, I suggested that he, of the many places that he should teach part-time in a high school somewhere in the nation, preferably maybe U.S. government. He'd be great at that. He doesn't have to dedicate the entirety of his life or his day to it, but I think, one, it would bring back some of his prestige. You know, the teaching profession has lost so much prestige over the last 10 years for, I think, terrible reasons. He is a person who is admired by many people across the political spectrum, and I think it would help inspire more men to go into teaching. I think it would help inspire more black men to go into teaching, and I think it will restore some of the prestige to a profession that has unfortunately lost so much of its social and social standing in this country and deserves to be returned to their standing, and I think he'd be a great model for that.
Again, the name of Cinque Henderson's new book is Sit Down and Shut Up, How Discipline Can Set Students Free. It's published by St. Martin's Press. Young people should probably not be slurping down so-called energy drinks for way more reasons than one. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Energy drinks are everywhere today. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Sean Nort, professor of pharmacy at Chapman University, looks into the effect these drinks have on the teens who consume them regularly.
Energy drinks may prove harmful for teens who consume them, and 81% of teens report drinking these beverages at least once a week. Nearly 30% reported trying energy drinks for the first time at age 12 or even younger. Results of a recent study show that 40% of teens aged 13 to 19 report at least one negative effect after consuming these caffeine-infused drinks. The most common reported adverse effects in this study were insomnia, feeling jittery, palpitations, abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, or diarrhea, headaches, chest pain, or shortness of breath. Of concern, 24% of teens report mixing energy drinks with alcohol or illicit drugs, including marijuana, methamphetamine, cocaine, LSD, and/or PCP. Reasons reported for using energy drinks include to increase energy as a study aid, to improve sports performance, because it feels cool, use while driving, and also the taste. Interestingly, several participants view these beverages as being healthy, and they're also being used for weight loss by some adolescents. There are currently over 500 brands of energy drinks available on the market, with sales reaching billions of dollars. How do teens choose which brands to purchase? Both brand name and packaging, as well as their friends' influence, played a role in their choice. Surprisingly, cost proved to be the least important factor. Currently, there are no age limits set in place to purchase energy drinks in the United States, although several countries have restricted sales to minors or banned them altogether. It may be wise to discuss energy drinks with teens before they start buying them.
That was Sean Nort of Chapman University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledges podcast or any of the other WAMC podcasts or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about this program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And take a look for our Twitter account. It's at TBOO Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next week for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.